You're listening to LawPod UK from the creators of the UK Human Rights Blog. It's a podcast that discusses developments across all aspects of civil and public law in the United Kingdom. All the comments are current at the time of podcast publication. LawPod UK is produced by the barristers at 1 Crown Office Row and is presented by Rosalind English.
In October last year, the European Court of Justice heard arguments about the marketing of rapeseed that is bred to be tolerant of herbicide. The applicant was a French agricultural union defending the interests of small-scale farming. In essence, the applicants contended that certain methods of genetic modification should be restricted under the GMO directive. It's a bit complicated because when that directive was passed in 2001, there were only two kinds of mutagenesis procedures: genetic modification of an organism that doesn't involve introducing foreign genes. The EU decided to exclude random mutagenesis from restrictions under the directive. Now, of course, we have CRISPR on the horizon and several other methods of sophisticated gene editing that are set to change the face of agriculture. The court agreed with the applicants that these new forms of mutagenesis should be restricted within the European Union. The judges ruled that genetic modification includes any technique that induces genetic changes, quotes, in a way that does not occur naturally, close quotes. I'm here in Cambridge with plant geneticist Professor Ottilien Laser, who directs the Sainsbury Laboratory. She has described the ruling as wholly inadequate. Professor Laser, many thanks for coming on the podcast.
Absolutely. There's a couple of things. It's not the ruling that I think is wholly inadequate, it's the law. I think the European Court were in a very difficult position, and in many ways the ruling they made was almost the only choice they had, given that they were ruling on what should be and should not be included in the law.
So, but can we just back up a bit and look at what is meant by natural modification of an organism?
Yes, well, that's a very interesting question, because I would say nobody knows what's meant by natural modification. The quote, as you say, is that the law includes things that were done in a way that would not occur naturally. Obviously, naturally, changes in DNA happen all the time. It's the stuff of evolution. The only thing that separates us from apes is thousands of mutations that have occurred naturally. And there are many things in the natural environment that induce those mutations. Sunlight, as we know, errors in the way your DNA is copied, just in the natural way of things. So mutation is a normal thing that happens all the time, and it's actually a good thing because it's the stuff of evolution and the stuff that gives us the potential to adapt to new environments in which we find ourselves. So it's natural. In domestication, we've been using these natural variations in genetics for 8,000-10,000 years to select animals and plants that are better suited to our needs as people. It's not natural selection, it's artificial selection, and the varieties and forms that we've selected are varieties and forms that would never have evolved naturally because they are very poor competitors in the wild. So a good example in the plant world is that we've selected very hard for plants where the seed stays on the plant so that we can harvest them easily, whereas in the natural environment that would be a very bad feature because you're not dispersing your seed widely and all of it would just drop immediately underneath you and you would be, as I say, a very poor competitor. So you can make a very strong argument that most of the agricultural varieties we have now would never have occurred naturally. Nonetheless, the process by which the genetic variation on which they are based arose was without any direct human intervention and is therefore natural. So this natural question is different depending on whether you're talking about the way the variation arose and the fact that it's persisted in the population because you've selected for it. And the quote of the court is that it's the way the variation arose. So then, under those circumstances, these conventionally bred varieties arose through mutations that occurred without intervention, quotes, naturally, whereas There's a whole range of things, including these random mutagenesis techniques that have been used since the 60s, where we did something to induce those mutations. And if you argue that what we do is not natural, then those mutations or genetic changes were induced in a way that did not occur, quotes, naturally. It's an artificial distinction. One of the things that the community is most frustrated about, I suppose, is the possibility that you could wind up with two crops that were genetically absolutely identical, which had been produced either by waiting around for a long time or by doing something directly, a direct intervention, and those two crops would be regulated completely differently because one of them, the genetic variation occurred naturally, and the other one, the genetic variation we put in. And I think that's a topic that's become particularly widely discussed in the context of these new genome editing techniques, where actually one of the things people are doing is deliberately going in and making changes that they have found in the real world, in the natural environment, because they know, because of the properties of the plants in the natural environment, that those are the properties that they want in the crop. And it's easier, quicker, all these other things, to introduce them through these new gene editing techniques than it would be to do the years of crossing to get them from one variety to another.
But we're just going back to 2001 when the directive came into force. An exemption for all these restrictions were made for certain types of mutagenesis that were deliberate.
Yes.
This is ionisation by irradiation and a couple of other techniques.
Yes, absolutely.
Why do you think then that was considered worth excluding from the restrictions?
So they are excluded from the restrictions, but one of the things that's interesting about the recent court ruling is that they clarify in some ways that those are genetic modifications under the definition of the law, they say, but they are excluded because they've been used for a long time and shown to be safe, whatever that means. So it's a exclusion by history rather than an exclusion by
science.
Yes. The court also says that if any individual state wants to include those again, then they can if they want to. At some level, to me, this entire thing is frustrating because we're spending a very, very long time deciding whether something counts under the law or doesn't count under the law, when really the things that people care about are the traits that have been introduced, the nature of the crop that you've produced. And indeed, explicitly in the case brought before the court, that this French Farmers Consortium, what they really cared about were herbicide-tolerant varieties of crops, as you say. Whether they were, and they cared about the ones that were also produced by random mutagenesis, of which there are many, which are currently completely excluded from the requirements under the EU law, and also any new ones that anybody made using genome editing, along with the ones that are around through what you now is now rather bizarrely being referred to as conventional genetic modification, which one of the most prevalent applications for conventional genetic modification is herbicide tolerance. So you've got herbicide tolerant crops. They absolutely could arise through natural processes. There are deliberately introduced random mutagenesis and then select the ones that have the phenotypes you like. There's conventional GM and now there's genome editing. So you could have four different sorts of herbicide-tolerant variety. They would all carry exactly the same in types of environmental risks, exactly the same considerations about agrochemical usage, all of those kinds of things. Some of them would be included and have to do all kinds of safety and environment assessments. Some of them would be excluded and wouldn't have to do any of those things and would go straight to the fields. And this particular farming group say what they really care about is the trait, the herbicide tolerance. They say that's the thing that's driving their anxieties. And if that's the case, then, as I argued, the current law is wholly inadequate because it's not paying any attention to that whatsoever. It starts from the point of how did you make the change, not from the point of what change did you make.
Yes, it's very interesting. I saw that in 2014, a group of biochemical experts in this country recommended that we looked at the attributes, the characteristics of plants,
yeah,
rather than how they were bred. Just like we look at medicines to determine whether they're safe or not. Why is this obsession with how they're bred suddenly, literally, taking hold?
Absolutely. And most of the community now is of the view that some kind of method that looks at the product and the way it's going to be grown and used in agriculture, rather than the way you produced it, would be the way that would genuinely protect the things that people want protected, namely the environment and the integrity of the food chain and human health, all of these things. It's really frustrating. Everybody in this debate basically wants the same thing, almost everybody at any rate, and that's, you know, a secure supply of reliable, safe food that is produced in a way with minimal environmental impact. It's very straightforward. How you go about doing that, I think it's very important to have a regulatory system that assesses any new agricultural practice or any new a product that's going into the agricultural system to consider those properties. And indeed, any new crop variety that you register currently, what you need to do is to prove that it's called distinct, uniform and stable. So you have to prove that it's doing what it says, and you have to prove that it has some advantage over previous crops, which is fine. You have to do nothing formally concerning its environmental impact, its safety, its potential effect on the food chain, all of these kinds of things. And to me, that's quite surprising, and definitely in stark contrast to a crop that you introduce using one of these officially labelled methods, whereupon you have to do all kinds of things. There are countries that have, instead, a product-based assessment. Canada is the one people typically point to, and it's generally considered that that's much more kind of logically robust as a way of thinking about things. That the drawback, of course, is then absolutely everything would come under this new regulatory system in a way that it doesn't, so there's some resistance to that. But I think if there was a sort of decision tree for the level of assessment that you needed, depending on how revolutionary your new product was, I think that would be a plausible mechanism to ensure that everything was considered, but not over-considered. I think that is entirely doable as a balance to achieve. And it would be robust to all any future technique that anybody introduced. This current legislation we have, every time there's a new technique, you're going to have to go through all this again.
This is often the problem with the intersection between law and science, and this demonstrates it so well. It's sort of constantly straining at the joints.
Yes.
And indeed, the Advocate General's opinion, which went against the decision of the court in the end, he said that what the applicants were arguing for was creating new legislation.
Yes.
Said, you know, rewriting the 2001 directive,
yes,
which said that only, you know, the mutagenesis was excluded. But sometimes this sort of conflict is inevitable, and perhaps the only way of dealing with this problem is to rewrite the GMO directive, or, you know, start from scratch.
I think that is definitely the best option. Take all that we've learned in the interim and build instead a much more robust, consistent regulatory framework that deals with products that you're introducing into the agricultural system. And as I say, there are precedents worldwide. There's another kind of twist to it, which is that currently conventional GM is not only legislated differently or regulated differently in terms of getting your seed varieties on the lists that can be sold, it's also different in the plant breeders' rights protection. So you get more ability to kind of protect and keep back your new GMO variety in a way that you don't with a conventionally bred variety, where other plant breeders are allowed to take it and breed on from it. And that, I think, has also been a sort of underpinning wave in this whole discussion. A lot of the public concern is really about who's in charge of these things.
So like Monsanto, exactly, preventing farmers from buying their seeds elsewhere.
Exactly.
Yes.
And so I think that's something that also could get wrapped into this. If everything was regulated under the same set of principles, that I think should also apply to the patent protections that the breeders and the companies who are producing these varieties have. They should all be equivalent, because they are basically all just ways of introducing variation, genetic variation, that is contributing, hopefully in a positive way, to environmental sustainability and the integrity of the food chain. So the whole thing, I think, needs to be picked up and wrapped into a single unified framework.
What about this country when we come out of the European Union, no longer bound by the directive? Do you think that there's scope for being able to start afresh?
I think, you know, this is something that's asked a lot. I think it's possible, but it will obviously depend hugely on the deal we wind up with, because if we are going to wind up being fully locked into the famous common rule book, then there won't be very much scope for changing. On the other hand, Canada, very famously, have now a very good trade deal with Europe, and they have this trait-based regulation of their agricultural products. So it's not incompatible to have this different type of system and still be in a good trading arrangement with the rest of the European Union. So I do think it's well worth looking at. And I think more generally, the common agricultural policy is a very difficult thing. Obviously, you're trying to have a common policy across the whole of Europe, but that means a common policy for agriculture in, you know, the south of Spain and the north of Denmark. And the idea that that entire landscape can be sensibly covered by a single set of rules is a little bit problematic, and it would be quite useful to be able to think about our agricultural system more generally in a more local way.
Certainly the different arguments of the various countries that intervened in this court hearing shows how different this kind of theology is across Europe.
Mm.
The UK, for instance, was arguing very strongly for liberalisation of these rules.
Yes, yes. So it was an interesting debate beforehand, and it gets back a little bit to this point about the law being about, potentially about how you made the change, not about what change you made. So a lot of the science enthusiasm came from the fact that it's entirely possible with genome editing to make exactly the same change as you find in nature. And therefore, if you stick with these current rules, there's going to be all kinds of traceability problems, because it will not be possible to tell the difference between something that was made in using some of these techniques and something that you found in nature. Even if you know the history, in principle, you won't be able to tell the difference. And so people felt that was a sensible way forward, and there were proposals that changes involving some particular number of base pairs should be excluded, and those involving more than that should be included, and that there were, you know, particular ideas put forward along those lines. And you know, absolutely, in the UK, people were on the whole more inclined to go with that kind of approach. If the law is about how you made the change, then that's not really an option. And to me, as I said before, I think what all of this demonstrates very clearly is that the law is really not adequate for the landscape in which we find ourselves. It's not able to cope with the change in the technologies, and it's not actually adequately protecting people now from the very old, long-term established technologies, because it somehow is of the view that if you made it using that technique, it must be safe.
Yes,
which is
because it's been around a long time.
The technique's been around a long time, but you can introduce genes that have never been in the food chain before using those techniques, and apparently, by definition, it's going to be fine.
That is ironic. Well, thank you so much for your very interesting contribution.
Thank you. Pleasure.
LawPod UK is presented by Rosalind English and produced by One Crown Office Row. For more editions of LawPod UK, You can subscribe to the podcast on iTunes and recommend us to a friend.